Welcome to the Assembling Inclusion Podcast. On this show, we feature different programs, individuals, and initiatives focused on being more inclusive of individual needs. We invite you to learn right alongside us. If you want some additional resources or access to our courses, please visit our website or follow us on social media. But for right now, let's get right to the episode. One of the biggest issues I've seen working in education is designing learning experiences that are truly supportive and empower our neurodivergent learners. That's why I'm so excited for this episode about Islands of Brilliance, a program that uses a project-based learning approach and was developed specifically to support children and young adults on the autism spectrum. Their programming connects art, design, and STEAM along with social and emotional competencies. In this episode, we interviewed Dr. Kate Siegman, the Director of Learning and Outcomes at Islands of Brilliance. We discussed the components of the programs, including the different tiers of program offerings, as well as the mentorship component, the different elements within these learning experiences that make them truly supportive for learners on the autism spectrum. So let's dive right in to learn all about Islands of Brilliance. Welcome back to the Assembly Inclusion Podcast. We're here today with Dr. Kate Siegman, Director of Learning and Outcomes at Islands of Brilliance. So Kate, thank you so much for being here with us today.
Thanks for having me.
So before we get into what Islands of Brilliance actually does, would you mind telling our listeners about the inspiration behind starting this organization and how it came to be?
Islands of Brilliance began with the diagnosis of our co-founder's son. He had an autism diagnosis. So Mark and Margaret Fairbanks had their son diagnosed with autism at the age of 4. And the neurologist immediately said, lower your expectations. So that fueled their passion to raise their expectations. They discovered that when they entered into their son's world via his special interest area, and in the autism community, we call these spins, they found that they could connect with Harry on another level, and he defied the doctor's expectations. Mark is a graphic designer by trade. And one day, Harry asked, hey, can I try that out? And he started playing with his Photoshop program. And they discovered that a whole new world opened up for Harry. So that was the inspiration behind Islands of Brilliance, using technology as a means for fostering student spins rather than extinguishing them. Today, Harry is a college graduate with honors. He's happily employed. He continues to foster his spin in trains, and he's actually one of our mentors at IOB.
Oh, that is awesome. I think that's such a relevant story, because that's something that I hear a lot from families of children who were diagnosed on the autism spectrum, is that, you know, either the school is trying to, like, as you said, extinguish mm-hmm. the students, like their spin or area of interest, as opposed to nurturing it. So I really appreciated the fact when I came across Islands of Brilliance that it's fostering and continuing to support that love and that passion. That's really important, I think, and special. So I saw that online, it says that Islands of Brilliance specifically is described as creating the quote unquote ideal environment for students on the autism spectrum. So what does that mean? And how does it differ from a traditional educational setting, like a traditional public school K-12 setting?
So it's actually really simple. I think in the education world, we overcomplicate it, but it's really simple. We use our students' spins, as I stated before, and creative expressions as entry point for engagement. So it's really less about the environmental factors within the room and more about fostering their inspiration. So after that, like once you enter into that spin, learning is really simple because we've already hooked them, right? That's always what we're striving for as educators, is hooking our students. Technology is kind of the cherry on top of the learning equation. So what we do is we engage the kids in an iPad program called Procreate or a digital design program like Photoshop or Illustrator. And that kind of hooks them. And then we say, what are you into? What do you love? When we pair them with that art mentor, the student's kind of the expert on their spin. And they say, hey, this is everything I know about dinosaurs. And then the mentor says, hey, I know a lot about Photoshop. I know a lot about Illustrator. Let's create something together. So it's kind of this egalitarian environment of mutual learning. And it really, really breeds this confidence in students that we don't always see in the regular educational environment. Of course, we say, are you auditory sensitive? Bring your headphones along. Do you need a little more space to work? Let's pop you over to another room. But outside of those physical environment, it's really more about that creativity, that inspiration, and that trust that the students know what they're doing and they're capable.
That's something I wish more educational settings looked toward, because you were right when you said that's the whole goal in education, is to hook and engage the students, but we're trying not to get them to be interested in their passion at the same time. It's like, oh no, we're not going to talk about that today. But it's like, that's what would hook them into the lesson. I'm not really sure why we're ignoring this. That's something I never understood. I had so many students who were interested in like Minecraft, or that was their area of passion. It was like, that was their thing. And like, oh no, don't talk about that. And I'm like, but that's what's going to get them hooked in language arts. Like, I don't know what else to tell you, but...
I mean, as educators, we have to understand that we're learning just as much of this as the student. And as educators, we're creative. And I think sometimes we forget that we're creative and flexible. We can reach learning targets through a means that's exciting.
I think that's a great point. And I love the point you made too about the mentorship being a two-way street with the learning, that the student is the expert in a certain topic that they like. The mentor is the expert in the technology component of it, and they're learning together. I did want to ask about the mentorship component. So how does the mentorship work? What is their specific role aside from working with the student? I think I read it's a one-to-one experience, but how does that typically work within the program?
So we gather our mentors. They're actually kind of an eclectic crew of folks. Our mentors are a mix of art and design students, as well as just professionals from the art communities. We have a lot of agencies that we work with who provide us with mentors who are graphic designers. We also work with some mentors who are fine artists, and we upskill them. We teach them how to use some of the digital arts programs so they have more of the art conceptual background. And their role really is to get excited with the students, learn from the students, and then they teach the students the program. So that's really their role. Now, I'm a special educator and occupational therapist by trade. So what I do in our programming is I circulate the room and I help be that conduit between the student and the mentor to make sure that they both have a positive experience and that we're meeting the student's needs.
Oh, that's great. Anytime there's like a mentorship component to something, I think that's really beneficial. And it's a project-based learning program, right? Like where the students are taking the skill that they're learning with their mentor, and then they do something with it related to their spin or their area of interest.
Yeah, it absolutely is. The reason why we chose project-based learning for neurodivergent students is because they can enter into a goal-directed task from the entry point that really works best for them. So instead of saying, here are your directions, now get to work, we say, what do you want to accomplish? How are you going to get there? And the cool thing about that is it encourages a more flexible yet mature way of problem solving that fosters that higher level of both social skills, self-management, and it's more of a natural environment, right? As adults, that's the question we ask ourselves. We don't say, this is my assignment. We say, okay, what do I want to do? How am I getting there? What are the steps I'm going to take to get there?
I think that's really awesome. I taught special ed before I went to technology. We always did the 20 time genius hour, which was great. It is open-ended like that. It was that project-based. There's no directions. You just pick what you want to learn and you do something with it. And I found that for my neurodivergent students, that was perfect because they didn't feel restricted by the box of directions. I always noticed that those were my students that were like, I'm just going to pick up and go. I know what I want to learn. I know what I want to do with it. I'm going to come up with my steps. And it is nice because it gives them more of that autonomy in their learning, which I feel like so often they don't get. Students, they're kind of like, here's your IEP goal, here's what you're working on, here's the curriculum. And it's like, well, where are my interests fitting into this? So I love that it's a project-based program for the students. I think that's really important.
Exactly.
So you had mentioned that the courses are art-based with technology infused. Could you give some examples of the curriculum and courses that exist?
We have kind of I don't want to call it levels of programming, but different entry points of programming based on accessibility. So we have kind of a base level program called Sandbox, and that's our most accessible program. That program really focuses less on technology-based learning objectives and more about that social connection through art. So the students will have kind of a drawing prompt or a storytelling prompt, and they engage however they want to. So some of our students will doodle on paper. Some of our students will pick up their iPad and start doodling in Procreate, which is a digital painting software on the iPad. And then some students are comfortable with Photoshop and will just pop into Photoshop and start creating. So that's kind of what we would call our most accessible. And then as we move along to that foundation design programming is our one-to-one mentorship model. So that one is much more goal-directed, as in you're going to create this poster centered around your spin. And then students can and mentors work together to decide what program will work best for their goal. So instead of saying, hey, this is a Photoshop course, the students will decide, hey, you know what? I really want something that's more tactile. So I would like to design on Procreate using the iPad. Or another student might say, you know what, I've really wanted to explore Photoshop or Adobe Illustrator. Let's enter in via that route. The challenge for us for that mentorship model, we have to get an idea of the type of learner a student is first, and then we can assign the mentor who is more of an expert in that program. Along with the foundations, we also have a special foundations that's more centered around three-dimensional design. So some students will choose to design in 3D, but that's kind of a separate program. And then we move up to our higher order program. Typically, we have older students in this program, but I'll talk a little bit more about age in a second. And that's called our Design Academy. Our Design Academy is much more like a workplace setting. So students are more of like a client ask. They'll work on teams to accomplish a design-based goal on that task. So they have to really work on the interpersonal work skills and working more on a timeline. So that is kind of our higher levels. As much as it's kind of like three levels, students can go into any program at any point.
Oh, okay. So they don't have to start at Sandbox. They could jump to the third tier if they wanted to.
Yeah. And depending on what student comes in with prerequisite skills, right? So we have some students who come in and they're like, yep, I know Photoshop. I'm really looking for some of these pre-employment skills, some of the pre-employment objectives and objective-based work. And then we'll say, hey, let's try Design Academy.
I love that there's the three different like tiers of it. I think on the website, it was like a triangle, right? Like where like the Sandbox was that ground level, like exploring and trying something out for the first time. I like that it kind of goes up from there to how specific it can get with the program. I really did like the fact that you had that kind of pre-employment chunk in there too. I thought that was something that was really cool because not only are they then getting to, you know, build on their interests and their areas of strength, but also then those are skills that can carry over into the workplace. It's almost like an internship kind of like a model. Yeah. Right.
It is. And actually, the interesting part about Design Academy is we actually work with real ad agencies and real companies to accomplish a goal. So, for example, this summer, we're working with an ad agency called Serpentine, and they have a project for us. So for our Design Academy students, they want them to design a mud flap for a bike. It's a project they have in collaboration with a company from Europe that designs mud flaps. And they are actually going to take the culmination of designs and use them for their pitch to that company. So we actually do work on real projects with real companies. It's pretty cool.
Oh, that's really awesome. That's great experience too. And that could like really lead a student into, this is something I really loved. I can explore this either post high school in higher ed or just go out and work or get another internship and get more experience to make sure I like this area. That's really great that they have that opportunity.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I noticed that you have both a combination of in-person and virtual workshops. Are there a combination of virtual and in-person? I'm assuming the academy is probably more in-person because you're working on a team, but I could be wrong. How does that typically look at each level, the virtual versus in-person?
So we really had to pivot with COVID. That's where the birth of our virtual programming happened, which was actually pretty cool because it allowed us to reach students all over the state and actually into some other states. But the virtual experience, we tried to make as close to as in-person as possible. So the virtual experience is on Zoom. And mentors are put into breakout rooms with students where they still accomplish that same sort of goal together. Typically, our foundations workshops are virtual and our sandbox workshops are virtual. We also offer in person for those students who really just, maybe they use augmentative communication, maybe they just need a more hands-on approach. Those workshops typically fill up. So the virtual is a really good option for students to have. They run the same way. We have the exact same format. I would say the only difference is that students get to be in the comfort of their own home. And some students really benefit from that because they have their safe place. They have their break areas. It removes that difficulty of transition to a new space. So there are benefits to both, and it's really dependent on the student. That's why we get a really good feel for the students. We do a kind of an onboarding process with students so that we get to know their needs really well before we recommend programming for them.
Well, that makes a lot of sense. I like that there's, in everything you've said so far, there's a lot of elements of flexibility, which I think are really great. Even in virtual learning, I saw students, particularly some of my neurodivergent students, they thrived virtual and at home. They were like, this is way better than being in the classroom because I have more control over my environment. I feel like I can focus more. I don't have the distractions of my peers around me. So it's nice that you have that option, but then also the in-person option for people who feel like that's more something that they want, to be around people, to be able to use their technologies and communicate with people face-to-face. So that onboarding process, before you even place the student, you sit down and you work with them to figure out what would be most appropriate for them. Is that how that works?
Yeah, we call that our concierge approach. So our concierge approach starts with a conversation with whoever is recommending them, whether it be the parent, the case manager, a therapist. And we really talk about what are the needs of the students? What are your mutual goals? Then what we have is a process called a lean-in. So the lean-in is a Zoom meeting. I'll tell you why we call it a lean-in in a second. It's a Zoom meeting with parent and student, educator, such as myself, and design mentor from our staff. And we talk to the student because we always think it's very important to find out what the student feels is their ideal learning style. So you talk to the student about their ideal learning style, any moments of sensory issues that we should be aware of or signs of frustration. And then the mentor and the student do a quick demo using one of our design programs. So they actually like hook the student, and we call it a lean-in. Because usually the student starts way back off on the edge of the camera. They're like, I'm not so sure about this. What is mom or dad signing me up for? And then slowly, as we start designing and engaging the student, we say, hey, what do you love? Let's put that up there. They start leaning in. And then they're in full focus on the camera. So that's what we call it, a lean in. So based on all of that information, then we're able to really make a recommendation. Hey, I think, the best starting point for your student might be a sandbox because you're looking for some of the social skills, engagement, and community building, collaboration. Hey, I think your student might really love a foundations program because they're really looking to hone their creative skills and they want to work on something that's more directed. So that's kind of our concierge approach. We really take time with every student to make sure we have a positive experience.
I could see how that would be really beneficial because then you really get to know what the student needs, what their interests are, what the family or caregiver's ultimate goal is too. I did mean to ask, is there a specific age range then? Like I know you had mentioned like the academy tends to be more preparation for post-secondary life, but is there like a required age range or does it kind of vary?
But we always start around 8 and up. Now, that being said, we have flexed down to like a 7, but we are mindful of fine motor skills and fine motor development. And it can be really frustrating for a student who has not developed the fine motor skills to interact with the technology. when we say eight and up, we mean eight and up. So we have some students who are into their 20s and 30s. And the age, as far as programming, is really egalitarian. We have some of our students who engage in Design Academy and Sandbox because they love them both. And we don't say no. I mean, that's fine. And we also understand the developmental model, right? So some students are really working on social and emotional regulation, even if they're at 16. So maybe Design Academy is not their best positive fit at this time. We have some eight-year-olds who are just really phenomenal at picking up the technology. They've grown up with it. They have their self-regulation skills kind of developed, and they're a good fit for Design Academy. So we really don't place a specific restriction on age because we want students to learn from each other. We want students to understand that maybe this 9-year-old's present was a 25-year-old's past, and they can kind of mentor each other in that regard.
Oh, that's really nice to build that community then. Yeah, you can learn from the people around you who have been through it. And then it's good to see too, like somebody who reminds you of yourself as, you know, a little bit older, and you could see that they've gone through maybe what you're going through. I'm always so conflicted about like leveling by grade level or by age, because people's interests just vary so drastically. And I've been in programs like summer enrichment programs where it's like, oh, this is for 7 and 8. And it's like, what if like a 12-year-old wants to learn that and they weren't there when they were 7 and 8, like then they missed it. So I like that you have that approach.
Exactly. And I'll add that as adults, we love to be creative and have fun. And sometimes, you know, we stifle creativity as kids get older because we say, hey, this is a young adult programming and this is where you're at. And we say, no, have fun, get your hands dirty as a 23-year-old, and you can engage in the same sort of fun that these 9 and 10-year-olds get to engage with. You know, it really is a community, and we're really saying you don't have to stop your creativity just because you've reached 18.
So you've mentioned like the caregivers and things like that, and the parents that are involved in the process of onboarding. You have community support programs too. I think it was called Lighthouse. Can you explain that program and how does that support the parents and the caregivers of students who are in the program?
So Lighthouse has really kind of become a grassroots effort from a wonderful group of IOB parents. So it was requested by parents. We just facilitate it virtually in the evenings when kids are going to bed. And it's a space where parents really connect and drive the conversations. We don't say, hey, this is our topic for the week. The parents come on. And they chat about life, right? So some have younger children, while others have children who are in adulthood. So it's a lot of resource sharing, a lot of advice, and really just more of a support group for parents. It's also absolutely free. So we say, you know, we will facilitate it on a schedule, but you don't have to be bound by income restrictions to get the support that you need from a group of parents.
I like that because the whole program really seems to be so community driven with the students. So I like that you have that factor in there too, because having the support for the parents or the caregivers or whoever is caring for someone, I think that's great to have that opportunity and available to them as well.
Yeah. And I think a lot of our parents feel like they're isolated, especially parents who are working with children who have a lot of needs. And they feel really isolated to their little household. And so I think it's just the best way for parents to connect in an accessible format.
Yeah. You remove the barriers of, you know, financial access to things, because having it openly available and sharing the resources within itself is great. In the same way that like the students are learning from each other as the younger student learns from the older student who's been through it. Same goes for families. I'm sure a family has been through something similar to some extent and maybe has some recommendations. So it's nice that you have that open forum for them as well.
Exactly.
So I did want to ask about, there's a summer sandbox camp coming up, right? Or, well, this episode is being recorded in July and I think it's in August, yes. Right?
The Summer Sandbox Camp is kind of my baby this year. I'm very excited about it. I've been building it from the ground up. So this year's summer camp is based on imaginative character creations that each student will make their first day of camp. So it's based around the premise that their characters are traveling to Milwaukee, where we're based out of, from another dimension. And they're tasked to create a Milwaukee travel brochure to bring home to the friends in the other dimension and promote Milwaukee and all the great things that Milwaukee has to offer. So we're collaborating with some local spaces, the Milwaukee Public Museum being one of them. And in this space, students are going to participate in an archaeological dig and learn the true stories behind the cultures that once lived in modern day Milwaukee. Our focus on our day with the museum is to teach students that in the past, museums didn't always represent all of the cultures in a space, and how can they rewrite that story of the museum? So they're going to create a digital curated collection based on their archaeological dig. So they'll do a project on that day, and then they'll move on to the next location, which is called the Urban Ecology Center. It's this beautiful space of haven within a big city of all of like this beautiful outdoor space. And then there, they're going to work on some hands-on art based on nature. So they're going to use found items to do some different artwork there. They're going to create a digital scrapbook, and then they'll tie it all together to document their experience in their travel brochure on the final day. So it's kind of this through line project with these mini projects within each space in the city that we'll create.
Oh, that's so awesome. It's the freedom to express themselves still, but they have those community then landmarks that they're also going to. So it's engaging with the community. It's building the creative skills. There's so much going on in it. And that's open to everybody, all ages too, right? Because it's a sandbox.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
Oh, I love that. That's awesome. And is the specific summer camp, is this new or is it then something that's been done in past years or just a new version of it?
We've done it in the past, but every year it's different, right? So yeah. The one component that is always present in Sandbox Summer Camp is it's a way for students to engage in different locations around the city and build kind of that community connection. But the projects in the Throughline projects are always different every year.
I love that. That sounds like so much fun. I'm kind of jealous because I feel like that would be something that I would love to do. That's really cool. This is kind of a broad question, and I know it's probably difficult to answer, but what do you think have been the biggest impacts that Islands of Brilliance has had on either the students or the families or the mentors since the program and the organization has started?
Oh my goodness. This is so tough because there's so many individual and then community-based impacts that he has had. And I've seen just so much progress. And I kid you not, in 1 to 2 days of programming with new students, they make this incredible leap of progress. But I think I want to tell a story. Is that okay?
Oh yeah, go for it.
A little story that kind of sums up the progress that students make. So we recently hosted some of our workshops at the statewide autism conference this past spring. And there was a young man who was super hesitant to come into the room. He would like peek his head in and then get nervous and walk out. And his mom had said he had previously had a meltdown in his hotel room, punched a hole in the wall, just got really, really anxious, just this ball of anxiety. So he finally joined us for a workshop and he connected with another participant really quickly. We were playing this board game together. And the other participant also had Tourette's. And she apologized every time she had a vocal tick. She was just, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. And finally he turned to her and he said, stop apologizing for who you are. This is who you are. This is who we are. Like, we are important. And they walked out of the room arm in arm talking about where they wanted to go for dinner. And his mother just broke down in tears. She just was like inconsolable. And she said how her son had never, ever had a friend before. Like never the inkling of a friend, and that his anxiety had always been way too high to engage at that level. So this was 1 hour of programming, 1 hour that broke the stereotype that individuals with autism lack empathy, lack social desire. And that's the impact that we see every day. It's really cool.
Oh, that's a really incredible story. Wow. And that really does show how open and comfortable of a space this really is for everybody to feel like they could be themselves and open up. That really just shows the power of all the programming that you provide.
Exactly.
I'm sure there are so many stories just like that, but that's a really great way to solidify just how important the work being done is and how important that type of environment is too.
I think it just comes down to, like, we're non-judgmental. We say, come in when you're ready. We don't force it. And they usually do. And the kids who have been in our programming for a while are just so welcoming. And it really just makes a difference. It's pretty simple. it's not rocket science. It's very simple, but it works.
I wish more organizations had that type of mentality. I feel like, and I always heard it from the school perspective, and it's so like, we're just going to throw everybody in the room and you have to be there and you have to do this. And it's not a welcoming environment a lot of times. So the fact that you have this, like, you know, space where people feel like they could be comfortable being who they are, it's just, you could see the dramatic difference. And my last question is really, I always like to ask, what's coming up in the future for Islands of Brilliance? Do you have any plans for expansion or any updates or anything for future years?
This fall, we are super excited to be moving into a physical space. So right now we're borrowing space at our local university's campus for in-person programming. And we recently received a grant that is going to allow us to have our own physical space. So super exciting. We'll have to be able to hold more in-person events, advocacy events, speaker series, that sort of thing. And we're also in the works of starting a fellowship program. So we're actually working with rural and underserved communities in Wisconsin. And we're working on upskilling educators and artists in these rural communities throughout the state to use the IOB model for programming within their communities. So we're really hoping to expand our reach in underserved communities with our in-person programming. So more to come on that, but it's all super exciting.
Those are really big updates. That's so exciting about the space, because I'm sure having your own dedicated space will make things a lot easier to have and offer more types of programming in person. And then I love the fellowship too, because I'm sure it's difficult for people in more rural-based communities to get access to this type of programming, whether obviously in-person traveling is difficult, then even just internet-based connections for people who are trying to do things digitally. So it's nice that you're going to extend it out so that more people have access to this type of work and not just people in a specific area.
Right. And you know, that objective is really about empowering communities. We really want communities to start feeling the interconnection that we've been feeling with our community as well.
That's really awesome. And I'm excited to see what else is in store for Islands of Brilliance in the future. For our listeners, I'm going to make sure to link the website and resources in the show notes. That way you can go correctly to it and check out some of the work being done. But I really want to thank you so much, Kate, for being here with us today. We're talking to us all about Islands of Brilliance and the amazing work being done with the programming there. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having us. We're just really excited to spread the word.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Assembling Inclusion Podcast. I hope the information in this episode taught you something new, gave you a new idea, or showcased a new perspective. If you liked the episode, feel free to leave us a review or comment. If you have a recommendation for an individual or an organization who would make a great guest, you can message us on Twitter or Instagram, or send us an email at assemblinginclusion@gmail.com. See you next time.